This is the Astrology University podcast, helping you find inspiration, insight, and connection through the study of astrology. And I'm your host, Tony Howard. Well, welcome everybody to this episode of the Astrology University podcast. I'm really excited to have Frank Clifford and Nick Dagan-Best with me today to talk about music. This conversation actually got started a few years ago, and Nick and I were talking about trends in music and planetary ingresses and shifts. And then a few years after that, Frank Clifford shared this really lovely mini poster that he created for the LSA, where he kind of maps out music trends and planetary sign changes from 1956 to 2011. And then flash forward to this year, 2018, and Frank has just released his new book of music horoscopes, which is a lovely anthology of 30 essays on music, covering lots of different genres and styles and musicians. And the book's also a benefit book. So he's going to tell us a little bit about that today. But I just thought that this would be a great moment to have a more in-depth conversation about music and astrology. So welcome, guys.
Thank you. Hi, Ben.
Thanks, Tony.
Cool. So I thought we're going to kind of meander through a few different topics today, but I thought we might just start talking about rulerships and music. A lot of students and a lot of people interested in astrology get curious about, like, well, what planets rule music? So I thought maybe we could just start there.
Well, I guess some of the obvious ones that get mentioned a lot are Venus, Neptune, and then Taurus by association, in terms of the
voice,
the pleasures, the voice, that element of art that sort of brings comfort and that Taurian feeling, I suppose, is a clumsy way to put it.
Well, well, Mercury's retrograde, folks, while we're recording this, so we'll all be maybe a little clumsy today, and that's okay. We'll just roll with it.
Yeah, and maybe we'll produce the backward version of this
podcast. By the end, we'll be somewhere.
Yeah. We'll release it on vinyl, and people will have to spin the vinyl backwards.
Exactly.
That's right. There'll be a message in there if we rewind this and play it backwards. I agree. I think it's the Venusian aspect of music is very much about pleasure, and also it's the Taurian sensuality of music, getting connected, being in your own space. But also, it's a very social planet, of course. So you've got the Libran side, and we connect through music with people, and so it has a very connecting message. It's very much a gateway, the Venus side of music. Yeah, but I find it odd that people always say, oh, it's Taurus, it's the throat, and it's Venus, and it's always linked. It's like saying actors are linked to Leo, and then leaving it like that, you know, and people being surprised that not all Leos are ratty, middler types, you know, in beaches that want to perform for their mum and scream and shout out and belt out a Broadway number. So to me, it's more complex than that, but certainly the idea of music as pleasure seems to come with the Venusian link.
Yeah, and then with Neptune, of course, being able to enter kind of altered states of consciousness, and bringing in the moon as well, feeling states, and how all that works together. I did a study once of film directors. If you look at a bunch of film directors' charts, not all of them, in fact, most of them don't have Neptune in the 10th house. You know, Neptune is said to rule film, and you don't see astrology doesn't work that cleanly. But what you do see is that their whole chart describes how they make films, or what they're interested in when they make films. And it's like that, I think, with musicians, of course, but also with us and the music that we like and that we're drawn to look at the whole chart.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the whole chart that describes certainly what a musician puts into music, and what that unique, an astrological chart being what it does, doing what it does, reveals the sort of the real individual qualities of a person. And that's exactly those individual qualities that musicians are trying to express. the good ones, the mediocre ones, what have you. I mean, that's the thing that they're going for. And I've noticed looking at, for instance, charts of jazz musicians that where that appeal to really find a unique individual voice is probably the most at its most crucial. I think of someone like Miles Davis, who had a Mercury opposition to Moon and Saturn, and he was known not for playing like a lot of his contemporaries, notes all over the place, really high notes, really no notes, and really fast and everything, but he would just play a couple of notes mid-range that would just break your heart because of the way they're placed, the way they're chosen. And so I when I listen to Miles Davis, I think just as much about that Mercury-Saturn opposition as I would, you know, wherever his Venus happens to be, which might say more about sort of the suits he's wearing, the musicians he's picking, and all that kind of stuff. And then a guy who played with him, John Coltrane, who was the opposite of Miles, who played the saxophone fast with a lot of notes and really loud and really aggressive. And he had a Jupiter-Mars opposition, a square Neptune. So a playing quality that really described his particular musicianship and what distinguished him from other sax players at the time. And I see that time and time again with instrumentalists, that the whole chart says stuff. And really, Mercury has something to contribute to music. Saturn certainly does, and so on and so forth.
I agree. I would say that the more charts you look at, do you realize that when you're dealing with a signature in the chart or different corners of the chart that speak louder than others, they're the ones that come out in the vocation, in the style, in the motivation. So I'm fond of saying there's no chart that says astrologer or musician, but it will tell you if you have a strong Neptune, you'll end up going into an area of life, whichever one it is, where you can express that Neptune. So whether you're serving fish and chips to somebody, or whether you're taking people to a higher state of consciousness, or whether you're stealing from them or drugging them or whatever it might be, Neptune's going to come out in the in your expression. So you find Neptune strong in the charts of musicians that embody the Neptunian ethos, rather than them all having that. The same with filmmakers. That's my experience.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm going out on a limb, but and maybe it's too obscure of a reference, but I would be surprised if the members of Rammstein, or I don't know how do you say that band name, Nick? Do you know that one?
Rammstein. I actually have date of birth charts for all six guys in that band on hand. Wow. If you need them.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'd be surprised if they had like a lovely Venus-Neptune aspects in there.
Well, I'll tell you, the singer in that band is a Capricorn, and this was something I wanted to bring up anyway, is why are so many of the great singers Capricorns? If I'm really going to make, and I'm, for the most part in this talk, I really want to avoid these, and I think we're all leaning toward avoiding these sun sign archetypes as stereotypes, like, you know, all singers must be Taurians, all, you know, actors must be Leos, so on and so forth. We're obviously abandoning that premise pretty quickly here. And with that in mind, let me run right back into the fire and say, well, why are so many Capricorns? It seems to me, maybe this is just how it appears to me, but it really does seem like they outnumber, as far as famous singers go, at least in the 20th century, we're all kind of 20th century music creatures on this particular panel. If you look at the 20th century, it seems kind of unambiguous that Capricorns dominate.
Yeah.
Any thoughts? Am I wrong?
My first thought is that up until fairly recently, to be successful as a musician, I mean, it took a lot of work, in some cases, a lot of business skills, a lot of savvy. And, now access to, since Napster started disrupting the music industry, and then now we're in this moment where somebody can just, you know, a kid can be in their room and learn how to play guitar and create videos for YouTube, develop a following and become a hit without having access to a record company, a record label, without like playing the game, so to speak, without knowing anything about business, just creating a video and putting it on YouTube. So I wonder if part of it has to do with something like that.
Hmm. Yeah. But I mean, there are people like, you know, Elvis Presley or Janis Joplin or Michael Stipe, Rod Stewart. These are not, you know, these are Capricorns, but singers, but they're not Capricorn singers who make me think of like, these were not people who had the sharpest business acumen. I mean, that wasn't what got them, you know, like they weren't those kinds of Capricorns. Eddie Vedder. I mean, it's a long list really. They're really singers who, seem to be able to communicate that really inaccessible part of the heart, the thing that makes great singers great, you know, usually something related to being able to emote and get across feeling, you know?
Yeah. Well, that makes me think too of, Lynn Bell wrote a really, lovely article, I think for the Mountain Astrologer, about the moon and musicians. And she talks about like, the moon in Pisces in particular with Frank Sinatra and Michael Jackson and, in the charts of people who are making that really rich emotional connection. So, I think if we were to just kind of get a big spreadsheet together right now with a bunch of musicians, we would even find that your Capricorn idea doesn't totally hold up in the context of a whole sea of popular musicians, that there's that everything shows up. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true.
Sure. I mean, I would say that Capricorn seems very interconnected with rock. And of course, it's an earth sign. It has a sensibility. And I wonder, yes, Lynn Bell, and the article is in the book as well. Lynn Bell's, she looks at the biggest selling singers of all time. You know, you've got Michael Jackson, Garth Brooks, who were the others? Frank Sinatra, and there was one other. All Moon in Pisces. That's very interesting. Joni Mitchell she covers as well, looking at that. Mm. I think one of the interesting things about Capricorn, and this is what Nick touched upon, is that it's a sign that maybe manages to get people connected to their emotions without necessarily doing it themselves. And maybe, you know, I remember an actor many years ago who used to go on night, on Broadway night after night. And I said to her, how do you do it? Because it was, the audience would cry with her, they'd laugh with her. And I said, how do you go through that experience? And she says, I do nothing. I don't feel anything. And I let them do it. So maybe there's something about the Capricorn that has a great ability to really represent something without falling apart. And I think in Lynn Bell's article on the moon in Pisces, somebody, I think it was Chris Christopherson, says to Joni Mitchell, you know, leave something for yourself because the moon in Pisces gives everything. And maybe the element of the real established, powerful rock vocalists of our time seem to be heavily Capricorn influenced. Rock and roll. Maybe it's the fact that they hold back and they allow the audience to feel. I don't know. What do you think of that, Nick?
Yeah. I think that has, I mean, if we're trying to sort of encapsulate the sign, there's something about that. I mean, Capricorns are ruled by Saturn and it's the exaltation about Mars. These are the two sort of rough planets, if you will, the tough guys. And certainly when it comes to a lot of the singers I'm thinking of, the Capricorn ones, they're bringing that out. There's something, and indeed it's rock. You know, maybe back in the days of opera, we wouldn't see such a preponderance of Capricorn singers because the idea in that genre is to sing sort of clearly, you know, I mean, the crystal clear, no rough edges. Whereas all the great Capricorn singers I'm thinking of have rough edges. It's almost the rough edges that make them great. Your Janis Joplins or your Rod Stewarts, you know, no one would hear their speaking voices and think, wow, you should be singing opera. You know, that these are really voices that lend themselves to the particular genre that they're performing in. So I think that's a really good point.
And mastery too, right? As a Capricorn idea, and that kind of focus and energy driving them, driving what they do and how that impacts their work. Mm. To a lot of the people that you mentioned, Nick, they had a lot of stamina as well. Like their careers spanned along a lot of time, and you know, the music industry kind of famously eats people and spits them out. Yeah, so it's not a, there's a whole slew of one hit wonders. There's a whole slew of people who made one great album and just couldn't hang with the whole, not just the music industry, but just the fact that you have to tour and you have to, you know, get up every day.
Yeah.
And then you have to play the song again, even though you hate it now, you know, and everybody's going crazy and loving it. And then there are lots of musicians who famously tried really hard to get out of that trap by saying, I'm not going to play the old songs. And then the fans get mad at them. And so all of those things seem like it might be a little bit easier to access for Capricorn.
True enough. I think apart from the musicians, there's the other thing, of course. I mean, especially when it comes to modern music, is being in tune with the zeitgeist. Not just being a master of something, but being a master of something at the right time and place. And there's so much in certainly contemporary music history where you can see that coming into play. And I think where the planets sort of look at that, you would look at Neptune, but I think you also look at Uranus, just in terms of the, you know, changing cycles, taste changing, you know, one decade you've got people with long hair and sideburns, and then suddenly the next decade everyone's gelling their hair straight up, and then, you know, the next time people are wearing torn jeans, and, you know, I mean, it just sort of like things go, hop from one style to another. I can't remember now how many fluctuations we've had between tight jeans being trendy and then really loose jeans being trendy. It's sort of like it goes back and forth, if you know what I mean. And at this point, I think we've seen maybe five or six turns of that. In the late 80s, early 90s, you had not just Neptune in Capricorn, but as of 1988, 89, Uranus moved into Capricorn and they made their conjunction in the early 90s. And this represented a major shift in the music business, probably one unlike anything that had ever sort of occurred since recording music began. And that was the way records were charting. Before 1991, it was record store managers would tell radio station people, yeah, you know, this Phil Collins record is selling the most this week. Okay, great. So Phil Collins stays at number one of the charts. And then in 1991, they started scanning the barcodes and charting record sales directly according to sales and not just according to what some record store manager said. And it was this huge revolution in how records were sold because they discovered actually no one's buying the new Phil Collins album. The young people are all listening to metal or hip hop and the older people are listening to country music. So suddenly Garth Brooks, Nirvana, acts like that shot up out of nowhere because it turned out they were actually selling a lot more records, even if they hadn't been represented in charts or their genres hadn't been represented in charts. And that was a real Capricorn era, you know, in terms of the zeitgeist. And it put a lot more control into the hands of the artists and also especially, most importantly, into the hands of the audiences. The audiences suddenly had a lot more power in terms of how that structure was maintained and continued. It's a Capricorn sort of thing, how business is done, you know. And really, in the history of recorded music, that's the only time we've had a conjunction between Uranus and Neptune. You know, the last time it happened before that, you had sheet music in terms of, you know, popular music. That was as far as it went.
Well, that's really interesting that you mentioned that moment in the early 90s and that shift of, looks like it's around late 1988. It looks like it first goes into... Uranus first goes into Capricorn in 1988 for a little bit, then back into Sag, and then fully into Capricorn, where you have Uranus and Neptune in Capricorn. And when I was just mapping out some shifts in genres and styles and changes between like the 80s up to the present, that's a moment that I noticed, because there are some sub-genres that kind of really jumped out. Well, grunge clearly was in a subgenre. That was like a main genre that emerged during that time. But the Manchester scene, with bands like Happy Mondays and Stone Roses. Their peak was arguably in that 90 to 92 period. And then there was a peak for a style called industrial or also industrial metal that had a moment there as well. And several others. There's a shoegaze scene, sometimes called space rock, and all of these kind of in the rock genre, of course. But there's an interesting moment there, right there, 90 to 92 and 89 as well. A lot of these bands, their first record came out in 1989, like right then.
Yeah.
So it is a really interesting. There's a sea change. There's a really qualitative shift where the big Whitney Houston ballads from the mid to late 80s aren't there. There's even a shift there. She starts to try to get a little bit more urban with her next records.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see hip hop change really drastically at that very time too. That's, you know, out of nowhere you have Public Enemy and NWA and sort of the gangsta rap thing taking over from them. From NWA, that is, not from Public Enemy, but even Public Enemy itself was such a sea change, orally, A-U-R-A-L-L-Y, vis-a-vis anything that had been going on in hip-hop even a year earlier. And yeah, in 88, you really could sense that everything was very, very different. Another band I'm sure both of you are really into, but another band that was just breaking out at that time was Guns N' Roses, right. Which is, I'm not the biggest fan, but you can see like they're sort of the canary in the coal mine in a lot of this, because up until then, that sort of that LA metal thing had all been about the sort of the hairspray and a certain kind of video and a certain kind of, there was a whole aesthetic that was created around it. And love them or hate them, Guns N' Roses sort of came out and said, no, we're just going to wear the clothes that we wear on the street, and we're not really going to do any of that hairspray stuff. And we're, you know, all these other bands are just pretending to be bad boys. We're actually some really dodgy individuals, legitimately.
Right.
And it kind of went from there. And from there, it wasn't that much of a leap. At least aesthetically, to things like grunge, to things like Nirvana, which really took that. I mean, one of the keywords of the era, which to me is so Uranus, Neptune, and Capricorn, was DIY. Mm. Right? Suddenly, you're supposed to be doing things yourself. You're not supposed to have, the big corporations managing you. And even if you happen to be someone who did have the big corporations signing you, you would have some sort of small label that you pretended to be with that was affiliated with the big, you know, you really, there were a lot of, some were legitimately doing it their own way and some were just pretending to, but that was really an important, it was almost like a sort of political thing in the culture where it was important to maintain that. And this was true again in all of the genres. Some of it had to do with the SoundScan thing, but I think that was sort of one of those great zeitgeist coincidences. The culture was leaning that way anyway.
Right.
Mm. What interests me as well, as an aside to what was going on with Uranus, Neptune, and Capricorn, is also the elimination of people over 25, over 30 in the music industry, actually. You notice that, particularly, maybe it's more prevalent in England, but you notice that in the charts in the 80s, late 70s, you could have any dodgy late 30-something, early 40-something guy performing. And by the end of the 80s, we're looking at a teen market, and we're looking at Capricorn, of course, the sign associated with age or the coming of age and experience. And what you've got is a reversal of that, really. And the older generation is out in terms of hit making, in terms of having a presence. And it's very youth centered. And of course, we've always had young people in pop music, and there's always been boy bands and young people, but there's a real shift in who's being allowed in now. And I think that's partly to do with the Capricorn movement there and the link to age.
Well, I think this might be a really great shift, time to shift into just talking about some of the ingresses. And Frank, I was so impressed when you shared this mini poster with me at the amount of work that clearly went into making it. I wonder if you could just tell people a little bit about why you made the poster, and if there are any kind of takeaways that you have from actually just creating it, from doing the process, from amassing all that information into that really lovely poster.
Oh, well, thank you. It's in the inside cover of the book, I must say, as well. I created it originally for the Mountain Astrologer, doing a music issue for them back in 2013, 2014. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to look at the major aspects, the major ingresses, and to see what was going on. And I did it in China. I had a week off. I was teaching in China and something fell through and I was in some remote part of China and with a internet connection, and I managed to finish it. Thank heavens. I don't think I would have done it normally. It was a huge amount of work. And I just, the poster has, which I can email people if they're interested in, or they can buy in the book. But the poster has a list of the main albums, the main releases as well, and how they link in to different aspects. Also things like the CD coming in under a Jupiter-Uranus aspect, and all sorts of different innovation during that time. So it was really, really fascinating to do. And size-wise, time-wise, I could only do 1956, 2011, but who knows? You know, there may be room for updating it in the next the next year or so. But it was what did I learn from it? I learned it's complex, and I learned that I guess the main cycles in music are the Jupiter-Uranus aspects that seem to bring in new themes every 7 years. Not 7 years; it's a bit longer than that. And certainly the Uranus moving sign does that as well. Neptune moving sign does that, and then you have to sort of integrate them all. And this is what's so interesting about music, is that while you've got Neptune moving into Capricorn and you've got all the pop stars trying to earn money for people in Ethiopia, and you've got Madonna as the material girl as Neptune moves into Capricorn, you've also got Pluto in Scorpio, so you've got to deal with that one. And you've got Uranus in Sagittarius, and the launch and the beginning of world music. So it's fascinating when you look at the outer planets and where they're moving, and you really are always juggling at least two or three signs and at least two or three different cycles as you're looking through them. And this is why we always have such an eclectic mix and different genres and subgenres sprouting up at different times, I think.
And it does look like, just glancing at it, one of the first things I noticed, just being pretty familiar with music from the 70s through the 2000s at least, is that when Uranus and Neptune come together in a sign, and especially in that moment where there's a shift and they come together in that sign, that seems to really describe a moment in music, that you can also see a shift in genres, or you can see a little period there, like the 90 to 92 period we were just talking about, or the 88 to 92 period. Yeah. And there's another one there in the beginning of the 80s. So that, you know, I was a big new wave fan back in the day, and also goth, and both of those genres kind of had their startup and peak in that 81 to 83 period. And it looks like that's also in 81 was when the first time when Uranus went into Sag while Neptune was in Sag.
August of 81 was when MTV launched. And yep. Of course, you can't talk about this era with really,
right,
not really addressing that. At least until the SoundScan thing happened a decade later. People kept making videos after that, but it was, that's exactly, this touches on things you're both saying. Frank was talking about how when you got into the Uranus, Neptune, and Capricorn period, how everyone was suddenly young, which is basically true. I mean, basically the old people got their own charts, you know, they got their Garth Brooks. Okay, old people, you go listen to your country and Western, and we won't have you in our pop chart, you know, spoiling the party anymore like you were so much during the 80s. So that was the thing. You had that category, and that's why we saw what Frank was talking about, where suddenly everything was really focused on younger people, because lo and behold, they were buying, you know, totally different they were listening to totally different genres and buying records by of totally different genres. So it almost seemed pointless in trying to sort of squeeze everyone into one phone box, if it will, if you will. So until people kept making music videos after SoundScan, but it really was a matter that took so much control out of the hands of record companies, which they really weaved very heavily in the 80s, where really to get signed, to get listened on, heard on the radio, anything like that. I think that was the peak period of people having to sort of jump through hoops and make a few people on the board of a record company happy and not really, you know, and these people didn't necessarily have to be in tune with the audience. They decided what people listened to. So that's something that really started with, I guess the business had always been like that, but I think it peaked with the 80s, and then the SoundScan thing in the 90s is put a stop to exactly that.
Well, it also seems like Frank Scott here noted that in November of 1990, that was when the Milli Vanilli lip-syncing scandal broke. And yeah, it's almost like you're seeing, you know, seeing behind the curtain of the record industry of the shenanigans that they've been up to in the 80s, where, you know, people who can't sing have huge record contracts and people who are really amazing don't. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's, yeah, just a matter of, like, you know, who you know and you know how you play the game and that the record labels are in tight control, and that ultimately becomes their downfall years later when the internet shows up and Napster and the whole thing is disrupted.
Right. And also I think maybe the Milli Vanilli and the sense of the plastic pop of the late 80s, early 90s was a result of the Neptune and Capricorn movement to some extent. Ooh. Because the idea of control, Capricorn, of the image of what's being sold, and it becomes, you look at Milli Vanilli and you look at anybody that's not really singing on their record, they're being sold because they look a particular type, and the image is being sold. So image is everything at that point. What you've got, of course, you've got the men in suits, and you've got the idea of it being run as a business, particularly in the late 70s and early 80s, as Nick said. And then you've got the Pluto people, like Madonna, Michael Jackson, Prince, very strong Pluto charts of people who are taking control for themselves. The rest are sort of coming out of the 80s with no royalties and no record deal. And then you've got a few of them who are real Pluto people, in my experience, who decided to do it themselves. And, you know, coming as a consultant astrologer with a lot of clients in the music industry, the one thing you really desperately want to teach musicians is to look after their own business and to take care of that. And they don't. They don't want to do it. They want to leave that to somebody else. They want to get on with the process of creating. And many a time over the years, I said to them, you know, they've learned about the business the hard way, but they need to learn how to take care of their money. And certain people, the Pluto people, know how to do that. And they might have to fight big battles like Prince did for many years of ownership and control, very, very Pluto issues. But ultimately, you're dealing with people who have control over their product, which a lot of the people in that time weren't able to have or weren't allowed to have. So you did have the control of the image, where image is everything. But one or two people really stood out as having wresting back that control, I think.
Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was really glad you brought up Prince, because as you were speaking, he was obviously the quintessential example of that. Pluto at the very end of Leo on the midheaven in his birth chart. And when Purple Rain came out, Pluto was at the very end of Libra, 29 degrees something Libra. So it wasn't only sextile as natal Pluto, but you've got this Pluto in a critical degree. And, you know, really something. I mean, I remember it was kind of a joke in the early 90s when he changed his name to a symbol. And later on, it emerged that this was actually this very savvy business move that gave him control over his own records while he could continue producing records while he fought out a battle for ownership of his older music. sometimes these things that, you know, confound people. And you remember, I mean, it was the kind of thing that people just sort of joked about. And then, you know, as time emerged, it turned out to be this really sensible, savvy trick he pulled, and it allowed him to just keep being a musician. Very Plutonian indeed. I mean, a survivor if there ever was one.
Definitely. I don't know George Michael's chart very well, but I know he was wrestling with the music industry and lawsuits and whatnot. Where it seemed like that was a time period in that shift, as I guess maybe the pre-Napster moment and in this time in the 90s when there was a shift that it was all part of what was unfolding, all these lawsuits against the record companies for artists to try to get control of their records. In some cases, you know, the record company would just own this amazing record and not release it. You know, I'm really interested though in Neptune in the Image, and this idea, one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation is it's sometimes taught that, you know, Neptune is the planet of music, and you can look at all of the music trends with Neptune shifting signs. But as we've already seen, it's not quite that simple. There's more to it. And yet there is something about Neptune and style that's coming through here. It's coming through in a complex way as it interacts with other planets and other planets in different signs. But I'm just wondering, earlier, Nick, you were talking about, I think both of you actually brought up fashion, and fashion is so intertwined with the music industry. When we talk about the grunge scene, we're not just thinking about a style of music, we're thinking about a way people dressed. We think about New Wave in the early 80s, same thing, and on and on and on, probably back through time. So what is that? What is that? What do you make of that? And is that all just part of Neptune's hand here, or do you have other thoughts about that?
Frank?
I don't really, so I'm going to pass the buck there.
Oh, okay. I mean, I do have some thoughts.
I was going to say, I think Tony described that very well. They obviously are hand in hand. So
did I answer my own question?
I'm curious to hear what the two of you have to say to add to that, because I think that's a big issue with Neptune. Absolutely.
When I look at Neptune, I mean, to some degree, I see it having to do with the image and the sort of the fashion involved. But I think what always sort of blindsides me when I look at Neptune and music is it seems to have a lot to do with the technology involved in producing music. You know, going from those old sort of microphones from the 50s to four-track recordings. You know, Sgt. Pepper was famously made on a four-track, but then by the time Neptune got into Sagittarius, people were really, you know, no one was using anything less than 12 or 16 tracks. And right when it went into Capricorn is pretty much when we see CDs making a coming out, and so on and so forth. So that's another facet to it. I know I'm diverting a bit from the fashion element, because I think the fashion thing is an interaction between, a number of the outer planets. I see Uranus being very tied to the fashion thing, in terms of sort of just like the flavor of the week. I know Neptune, we think, you know, archetypally it has more to do with glamour and things of that nature, and I get that. And I'm not saying I don't see that in music. But I'm hard pressed, I think, to think of like a musical genre being tied to Neptune changing signs from year to year. I don't know. What sort of specific things did you have in mind, Tony?
Well, I think that as I was learning astrology, I've heard teachers describe Neptune's shift in sign with changes in musical genres. And as I was listening to those teachings, I was already kind of questioning it. And looking at Frank's poster here, you can really just see it, because, Neptune, for instance, goes into Capricorn in 1984. And then it goes back into Sag for just a few months and then settles into Capricorn. Then it's in Capricorn until 1998.
Yes.
There were so many shifts and changes in the music in that period. You can't say that the style of music was had one vibe from the beginning of that period to the end of it. And so,
And yet 1984 to 1998 perfectly almost bookends the advent of CDs to the advent of music on the web.
Right.
Napster is, if not, I mean, 2000, 2001 was in brouhaha of what was happening, but I'm pretty sure by 98, Google's, you know, came out in 98, just as Neptune was changing sign. And I'm pretty sure that the file sharing thing was, you know, slowly growing. And by 98, you can see it sort of moving from one side to the other. So again, I think the point about the, and these things change. I mean, this in a way, this does go back to the aesthetic, if not actual fashion, if not the hairstyle of a singer or what have you, the changes in technology and how music is shared and purchased and all that winds up having a lot to do with the culture, right? I mean, how many baby boomers do you hear opine about, you know, they don't have those big record sleeves anymore, so that when they're listening to their Jimi Hendrix record, there's no way to, you can't roll a joint on a CD cover, I think is the complaint they'll always make. You know, the going from big vinyl records or going from little 45s to big vinyl records to CDs to file sharing, these are huge shifts. And I think you can follow Neptune's change from sign to sign more looking at things like that than anything else related to the business in some way.
Yes, and also the other idea, of course, is that the Neptune you're born with will then is the seed, and it will grow in. You'll grow up and listen to music of another Neptune generation. So the Neptune in Sag people will grow up listening pretty much to Neptune in Aquarius and beyond. So the seed of your Neptune sign. When you get into music, usually in the teens, in the early 20s, developing it, possibly taking it up, some sort of hobby or career around that time, you're already in another era. So it's interesting when you look at the punk movement, you've really got the Neptune in Scorpio people born with that, who are being yes. woken up while Uranus is in Scorpio in the 70s. So in a way they work together, other than just saying, okay, now's the time for Neptune in Pisces to lose ourselves in this and that. You're dealing with people who are born of a particular Neptune generation seed, and they're having to deal with that. So the Neptune in Capricorn group of people who are now 30-something or 20-something, 30-something, they're all 20-something, 20 to 30-something, aren't they? They grew up with a sense of entitlement. Neptune in Capricorn, I'm going to be somebody, I'm going to be a wife and girlfriend, I'll marry somebody, I'll do, you know, there's a real sense of entitlement that came in the 80s. And they're living and dealing with Neptune while it's in Aquarius, which means I'm entitled, I'm special, and I can go on to any music show and show the world how talented I am. So the Neptune and Capricorn are having to merge that, work with that, and deal with the current state at that time, which was Neptune and Aquarius, where anybody could be famous on Idol or X Factor, whatever it might be. So you're always looking at, in a way, the current Neptune generation or the current Neptune sign selling that ideal to previous Neptune generations. And some of them don't buy it. Some of them naturally assume the role. So you're always dealing with not just the now, but also what you're born with and what you've gone through. I hope that's clear.
That's very on the mark. I think that's key, is really what's in the natal chart and what planets come along to sort of trigger that and usher it, you know, give it a highlight in the zeitgeist. And it's funny that you bring up punk when Uranus went into Scorpio in the mid 70s and went over the natal Neptunes of all those, you know, initial punk guys, most of whom had Neptune in Scorpio, except for a couple of the Ramones. You know, that was one of the first instances where you could have Uranus sort of triggering the natal Neptune of a musician. Because in more recent times, after the Uranus-Neptune conjunction, it's really the Pluto transit that comes along and triggers people's natal Neptune, not the Uranus. And, you know, a lot of those older acts, that was the way it went. I think of the Beatles, three of the Beatles had Neptune in Virgo, and then George Harrison had it in Libra. And it was right when Uranus went into Libra, pretty much, that the Beatles broke up. And he emerged as the guy who, you know, he was the one who had a big hit record after the Beatles broke up. He was sort of the single Beatle going out the gate, whereas Lennon and McCartney, you know, struggled. I mean, Paul wound up doing well later on. But during the Uranus and Libra era, it was really George who sort of took off out of the four of them. And he wouldn't necessarily have been the one you would have put your money on had you been betting in 1969, which one of these guys is going to be a successful solo artist.
Thanks for that, Nick. I think that's, we actually just got to this moment, I think, where it came together a bit, which what I was trying to get at, because you were talking about, started out talking about punk and Uranus moving into Scorpio and how it's triggering those guys' charts. And that's what the scene emerges out of. But you can see this on Frank's lovely poster right there around 1975, 76. And of course, the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK was released in November of 76. And that's right when Uranus went into Scorpio. But Neptune, on the other hand, had already been in Sag for several years. There was no punk in 1970. Just so punk isn't just, it emerged during Neptune and Sag, but it wasn't just Neptune and Sag. And there's a complex relationship between the planetary ingress and how the planets are interacting with each other, but also what they're triggering in people's natal charts. So and as to what can emerge during that time. So beautiful, amazing, guys.
That 1975 to 1980 window is a very special window because you have Uranus and Neptune in adjacent signs as opposed to sextile signs like they'd been in the 60s or conjunct like they would be in the early 90s. And I think that's, you know, I mean, it says a lot about so much of what was going on in the culture at the time, where everything was really disjointed, where you had the you know, the punk culture, which had nothing to do about trying to be appealing. You were trying to be unappealing, really. You know,
right.
Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious. I mean, you're not trying to say like, "Hi, everyone, love me." It was kind of like quite the opposite.
Although you do have Fleetwood Mac's Rumors at the same time, so just to muddy the water.
Yeah. Well, that is I think the thing about Uranus and Scorpio and how that relates to Fleetwood Mac. Actually, this is true throughout the 70s when Pluto was in Libra. And this is, I think, how we can usher Pluto in there. When you think about it, Pluto and Libra, all the top-selling acts were couples going through divorce, whether Fleetwood Mac or ABBA or Sonny and Cher. I guess the Captain and Tennille really hung it, even on the same, you know, they're kind of a one-hit wonder. But a lot of those really big 70s acts, divorce was a big thing, like sort of making it big together and then sort of blowing up. And Fleetwood Mac's Rumors is just sort of the toppermost of that phenomenon, because it was the divorce is in the record, you know, like the whole record is just about, you know, how all the couples in the band are breaking up and sleeping with each other and all this stuff. So there is something to Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, but I think it also speaks to something that Pluto seems to be contributing to the zeitgeist that we haven't really looked at yet.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of how it works, we're already seeing that there's a complex mix and that there's a dialogue between all these planets, and that it's not just Neptune, which is kind of where I was trying to arrive as the point of this conversation. So really appreciate that. And this might be a really great moment to talk a little bit more about this lovely book of music, Horoscopes, Frank. And I was just wondering if you can tell people what inspired you to create it in the first place.
Oh, well, it was back in 2014, so it's taken a few years to get it sorted. I my excuse is that I ended up traveling to about a dozen different countries to teach, and life just got in the way. and other books and other commitments. So, but the idea originally was to, knowing that most astrologers are either musicians or musicians on the quiet or interested or some way connected to music, I thought, why not get the community together? That was the idea, to get the community together and have people submit articles to fundraise. So, and I thought, what can I fundraise for? And at the moment, at the LSA, the school that I run in London, I do a lot of people leave their books to us, donate books, and I take them in when we have seminars, when we have group meetings, and people, all the students end up buying some amazing books for a fraction of their price. And over the years, we've raised money to then send the students to different conferences, mainly the AA conference in England. And I thought, why not go a little bit further and raise some money and send anybody who wants to, can go to my website, check out, buy the book. And also in a few months' time, we'll have a list of the money that we're raising and apply for a scholarship or part scholarship to an astrological conference somewhere in the world. It could be the one in India. It could be the one in NORWAC or the next UAC, whatever it may be. But the idea was to raise enough money to help people go to these conferences. The only proviso being that it's not a conference that I'm running, so there's no conflict of interest. So it's anything that's non-LSA. About 80 people, I've contacted a lot of people at the time. I think a lot of people were busy. We ended up having about 40 or 50 essays. The recent UAC conference in Chicago stimulated me to push me finally to get the book finished, because it was hanging there and it needed a lot of editing, and ended up taking the very best of the essays, hopefully publishing some others in other places, but taking a good 30 essays from people like Stephen Forrest, yourself, Tony. You did a great essay on the on Mars and female rockers, rock stars, rock singers and performers. Just a whole range of essays on people, genres, and along with about 550 charts as well. So there's a lot to absorb. If you're interested in astrology and interested in music, you'll get something out of the book, and you can have some fun looking at the poster you mentioned as well. So that's in there. But it was an interesting project done, hopefully, to unite the community. I mean, astrology is a very personal thing, and people get into cliques of, you know, you don't use Chiron, you can't be in my group, or you use the outer planets, I'm not speaking to you ever again. We can get a little bit territorial about what we use, what we do. And people are like that with their music as well, of course. So it's been an interesting ride in the last few months, because it has stimulated a few bits of envy and a bit of negativity in places. But the general idea is to raise some money, get people looking at charts and doing what we all love to do, and that's looking at charts and learning astrology. So that's the idea. That was the idea. Yeah.
When you bring that many people together, there's bound to be a little bit of drama there, especially when you're talking about something like music that's, you know, so personal. And I remember early on seeing somebody say, why isn't there any jazz in there? I'm like, have you actually opened the book? There is.
You know? Well, the only thing there isn't is classical. And I realized that if I was going to open up the classical genre, the book would be twice the size. I'd never get it done. And so what we're doing is we're taking those essays that were written about classical composers, putting them in the Astrological Journal over a couple of issues later this year. And hopefully that'll be interesting for people, particularly those who wrote took their time to write the essays. But you're always going to find people who think that they own a particular planetary cycle, or that the only people that should talk about it, or that people should be the only one to talk about Leonard Cohen, or, you know. And we get very territorial. But the funny thing about the book as well is that every chapter is linked to a particular sign. So you've got the idea of Gemini being pop music and also pop idols, and that sort of light Gemini feeling Cancer is a chapter full of people who are singer-songwriters, country and Western artists. Leo is the pop royalty. You'd be pleased to know, Nick. We've just given that the Leo chapter. Virgo is, I'm sorry, Tony, but Virgo is the data of everybody listing and data. Scorpio is disco and that sort of provocative music. So Sagittarius is world music and the people that have reached out into different genres in the world. So I've had fun creating it, and I hope it stands up as a fun book to dip into and check the chart out. Lots of new people that haven't been published elsewhere got their charts in there as well. So looking forward to some positive feedback, and thank you for promoting it as well. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, and could you tell people, you said they can find it at your website. Can you just tell people what that website is?
Yeah, they can go to frankclifford.co.uk and check out the book section. If you click on the music book there, you'll get details of how we fundraise and what to do and how to get in touch. It's early stages, but we'll keep people informed of the money that we're raising. Hopefully it'll be a nice amount to be able to send people off. And one of the things that, having done that over the years with students, you know, students really, they come to class every week or they come online every week, and it's great to see them and connect, and they connect with each other. And then all of a sudden they realize they can go to a conference, and then they meet some amazing people, and they listen to a whole range of people. And I'm a big fan of getting students, whoever they are, my students, anybody else's students, to learn from everybody, to get it, to dip into everybody, just because different people speak to different students, and you learn. I've learned over the years from listening to pretty much everybody. Sometimes I listen to people more than I do others, but it's been you never stop learning, and you, by being eclectic, you end up really never falling into one camp of a particular only way to do astrology. So hopefully the conference idea gets people out there meeting and changing their perspectives and their ideas of astrology.
Nice. That's a beautiful mission. I love it. Well, says one Gemini rising to another.
yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thanks guys for being here. This is great. I would love to just nail down all these like crazy details about these genre shifts and look at these minute moments in music history. And gosh, there's just so much rich material here. But for folks who are interested in that, definitely check out this lovely poster in Frank's book. That gets you a start for sure.
And also, Nick has a website as well that's got essays on astrology, haven't you, Nick? On music?
I do. I'm reconfiguring it right now as part of a big project to consolidate all the little sort of bits and pieces that I've been churning out over the years. So I'm stand by for a big sort of relaunch, but I'm actively doing that right now, and it should surface soon. But I'm you know, just like a lot of your favorite musicians, it's not ready till I say it's ready.
That's great.
But I think I can't wait to see the book, Frank. I'm really excited. I think it's a fantastic project, and the way you've shepherded it and the you know, what you're doing with the money that it brings in, I think that's fantastic. So,
well, thank you.
Can't wait.
Well, I look forward to talking with you guys again soon. And Nick, could you just tell people the address of your website for when you do relaunch it, and if they want to go check it out?
Yeah, it's my name. It's nickdagenbest.com. And cool. It'll be there.
It'll be there. It's there now, and it'll be something new and spectacular soon. Cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to talking with you all again.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Astrology University podcast. Study astrology online with some of the great astrologers of our time at www.astrologyuniversity.com, where we offer webinars, online classes, and virtual summits to bring you inspiration, connection, and insight through the study of astrology. Take good care, and we'll see you next time.